Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up later this hour, we'll have a call-in with your reactions to the new bill passed by New York City Council to ban smoking in all city parks, beaches, and pedestrian malls like Times Square. And on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, we have a thoroughly unscientific poll question about this. Now that the council has passed this bill, should the mayor sign it? Should the mayor sign the bill to ban smoking in all city parks, beaches, and pedestrian malls like Times Square? Register your response at itsafreecountry.org. Now, as most of you know, the Bipartisan Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission released its three reports last week about how the country got into the housing and banking meltdown that still plagues us. It was three reports because the majority Democrats on the commission issued one, three Republicans issued a dissenting view, and one other Republican issued his own dissent. They did not come to a consensus report like, say, the 9/11 Commission. We are very happy to have an opportunity this month to dig deep on the commission's findings and its implications for our lives and economic futures with the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Phil Angelides, who has agreed to do a weekly series with us all this month, beginning now. Mr. Angelides is a former California state treasurer, a job I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, and he was the Democratic candidate for governor against Arnold Schwarzenegger there in 2006. So, Phil Angelides, thanks so much for giving us four slots to go into depth on the Inquiry Commission's findings. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you very much. And for part one, I want to go deeper on something that we've talked about a bit on this show, but I think remains a mystery to most Americans and was one of the things at the heart of your report, the shadow banking system. Can you give us, to start, your best definition or description of the shadow banking system and where that term came from?
Well, first of all, let me start with the term. Apparently, the term was coined relatively recently. I believe it's been attributed to Paul McCulley from PIMCO, you know, the large bond manager based in California. Mm-hmm. But the shadow banking system, and we detail this in our report, really starts developing in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, and by the early 2000s overtakes the traditional banking system in size. And what the shadow banking system is a set of bank-like activities, finance activities that take place outside of the regulated banking and thrift or savings and loan system that this country had really lived with and built its finance system around since the 1930s, all the way through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. So it constitutes a whole range of functions. For example, in the 1970s, the growth of money market funds, where instead of people placing their money in a bank in a thrift because the amount of money they could earn was limited, they put money in money markets, which were much less regulated. It encompasses things like the repo market, which grew to be about $3 trillion in size. It was essentially borrowings between investment banks and other financial institutions that was not very well regulated. In essence, what the shadow banking system was a whole range of bank-like activities. I might add a lot of the mortgage originators, Ameriquest, New Century, a lot of the subprime lenders, they weren't banks. They didn't fund themselves with deposits. This parallel banking system or shadow banking system, called that because it wasn't very highly regulated, in fact, very lightly regulated, grew enormously. And by the beginning of 2008, it has $13 trillion of assets, while our regular regulated banking system has $11 trillion.
Sorry, what we were referring to as the shadow banking system includes the investment firm giants, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, et cetera?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because, again, they don't have a deposit base. They don't have the backstop of federal deposit insurance, and they don't have the same kind of regulation as banks and thrifts. And so you end up with much of your banking system unregulated. And the other phenomena that happens as these unregulated institutions or lightly regulated institutions get to do more and more, the banks and the thrifts are screaming, what about us? So it also sets off a loosening of regulation in the banking sector, in a sense, a competition to be able to participate in the least regulated parts of the market. And one of the best examples of that is, of course, in the wake of the great crash of 29 and the Great Depression, the Glass-Steagall Act was passed, and it prohibited banks from selling securities, because one of the things that happened in the 1920s is people would go in their bank, they thought this was a place, a safe haven, only safe investments, and they would be sold highly risky securities. That was banned by the Glass-Steagall Act right after the Great Crash of 29. Well, as this shadow banking system grows, all the banks say, like Citigroup, gee, we want to be back in that business. Why can't we be back in that business? So the walls start to come down, and banks begin to be allowed to do some of the risky things that they had previously been prohibited from doing.
So how much do you think that the growth of the shadow banking system and the risks it was allowed to take unregulated was the result of well-intentioned mistakes and judgment by the government? And how much the result of Wall Street coming to own the government, if you will, through campaign finance and lobbying and things like that?
Very good question. If you look at the book, and in fact, this is really detailed in part two of our book, which we call Setting the Stage, there is an element here of changes are made without full consequence and full knowledge. But there's also a very clear element here of an increasingly powerful industry swinging its weight, its power, and making big changes. And I want to say something. It's beyond the money and contributions. I didn't think it surprised us at all that this was an interest. Industry that spent billions of dollars in lobbying and campaign contribution. What disappointed us was that we didn't have regulators and policymakers who had the backbone to stand up to this powerful industry. But all along the way, it's the financial industry pushing for changes to loosen the grip. And, you know, there's great examples of this. Probably the best example is what happens with derivatives. You know, these sometimes very benign instruments that companies use to hedge their risk, like a company, like an airline company that wants to hedge its fuel costs. But the derivatives market begins to grow. In the 1990s, over-the-counter derivatives are deregulated. Then there's a series of scandals from Orange County to Sumitomo Bank to Procter & Gamble, where literally billions of dollars are lost in big derivatives meltdowns. Then Brooksley Bourne, one of our commissioners, suggests that we should be regulating this very large, growing market. Then there's the meltdown of something called long-term capital management that's so severe that the Federal Reserve in 1998 has to engineer essentially a $400 billion private bailout of that highly risky hedge fund. In the wake of that, you'd think people would say, hey, let's take a look at regulating this derivatives market that's growing like a cancer. Instead, the financial industry, along with policymakers, decide in 2000 they're going to completely deregulate it. And one of the big problems that happens as we get into the crisis, and we detail this in our book, is you have such big swaths of the financial market where there's no regulation, no transparency, no information, that when the crisis hits, key policymakers, whether it's Tim Geithner at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, whether it's the Treasury, whether it's the Federal Reserve, they don't know what's happening. They don't even have their finger on the pulse because they've allowed a financial system to evolve without asking the questions, without getting the information mm-hmm. that they need to control this burgeoning disaster.
We have about 10 minutes, folks, for phone calls. If you want to get in with a question for Phil Angelides, the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, specifically about the shadow banking system, and we'll take up other pieces of the report in the next three Thursdays, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 on shadow banks. Do you believe that the shadow banking system needs to be abolished to prevent similar risks in the future?
Well, it needs to have some measure of control, and it also needs to have a real measure of transparency. I mean, let me tell you how out of thing hand things got. You mentioned the investment banks. By 2007, all the major investment banks, which had grown like weeds, by the way, from 2004 to 2007, they had grown from $2.5 trillion in assets to $4.3 trillion of assets. These were all these institutions, they were levered as high as 40 to 1, which means for every $40 of assets, they only had $1 of capital to cover losses. So if there's a 2%, a 3% drop in the value of their assets, they're wiped out. Enormous risk. If you look at Bear Stearns, I mean, it's a classic example. Bear Stearns had about $12 billion in equity. They had about $380 billion of liabilities, and they were borrowing as much as $70 billion in the overnight markets. Now, just to put that in real terms, that's like a small business with $50,000 in equity borrowing $1.6 million with about $300,000 of that due every day, that they have to renew every day. It was crazy. It was out of control, and there was really no handle and no knowledge. One of the things we point out in our report is, as this crisis is developing, it's only 1 month before the big crash in September of 2008 that the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Federal Reserve try to figure out what will be the impact of Lehman's 900,000 derivatives contracts that it has with other financial institutions if Lehman goes bankrupt. Mm-hmm. They don't know. And they're now afraid to ask because they think if they ask, they'll set off further panic. So I would say our financial system is like the heart of our economy, and you need a regular heartbeat. And look, I come from the private sector, so did many of the members of this commission, but we believe this was one area where there were big gaps in regulation, and even where there was the authority. Let me tell you, there was plenty of authority. The Federal Reserve had it. The SEC had authority over the investment banks. Unfortunately, the sentries weren't at their posts. And we believe, I want to say, that this was avoidable. This did not need to happen. This was a series of human actions, inactions, and misjudgments. This wasn't an ill wind that just blew in.
And that, I know, is your key conclusion, that this was preventable. Before we go to a couple of phone calls, I don't know whether your report takes a position on whether the Dodd-Frank reform bill sufficiently re-regulates the shadow banking system. Do you take a position?
Well, we were very assiduous. You know, our job was to do the historical account and not really to be commenters on the present law. But here's what I would say about the bill. The bill is a start. I wouldn't say it's the end of the day because, you know, in the 1930s, it took a decade to reform our financial system after the crash of 29. But here's what's really key. You know, when Dodd-Frank was going through Congress, there were about 3,000 lobbyists from this financial industry trying to kill it, water it down, slow it up, weaken it. The law passed. Congress passed it. President signed it. But now to make it real, different regulators have to adopt 243 rules. They got to conduct 67 studies. So really, we don't know yet whether we're going to come out with strong, tough rules or, you know, the battle and the debate's just beginning. We hope our report is a guidebook to show people what went wrong so we have the right kind of rules. And I'll add one last thing on this. Mm-hmm. Even though there were big gaps like the shadow banking system, let's be clear, regulators had a lot of authority in a lot of places, and they didn't stand up and use it. The biggest example of this is the Federal Reserve. They are the one entity that had the power to regulate mortgage lending in this country by all lenders, whether they're shadow bank lenders or a commercial bank. They had a plethora of information from the 1990s on about out-of-control, egregious, predatory lending, and they sat on their hands. They never adopted real rules until July 2008 when the ball game was well over.
Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Phil Angelides, chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Hi, Bob.
Ryan, how you doing? You continue to do an amazing job.
Thank you.
Mr. Angelides, I'd like to ask you a question. You know, I read the New York Times every day, Wall Street Journal. You said things on this show, which I've never even heard the Times talk about, or Wall Street Journal, about the $13 trillion bigger than the banking system. My question is, how is it that they put your report down, that it didn't do a big deal, but yet they don't talk about the specifics that you've encountered and make it clear to the public. It's almost like a conspiracy by the newspapers not to inform the public.
Bob, thank you. And conspiracy or not, do you think, and do you go there in the report, that the financial journalism establishment, the financial media, missed this as well and that they should have known?
Well, first of all, we didn't deal with that subject, even though I might say there's an excellent Columbia Law Review article on this very subject where they account for, people might want to look at it, how the financial press did. I'll say this. I think a lot of the coverage in the first few days is, frankly, the political coverage. Who said what? You know, they picked the highlights out. But we're now beginning to get some thoughtful pieces. Gretchen Morgenson in the New York Times did a long piece about the book in which she said it was compelling reading. In fact, Michael Lewis, you know, the author of The Big Short, Liar's Poker, yesterday said he had read the whole book and found it very compelling. Bethany McLean, who writes for Vanity Fair, called it a great read. I mean, what I'd urge people to do is go to our website, fcic.gov. The whole reason we did the report was, frankly, to do the kind of in-depth history that you're not going to be able to get in a daily newspaper. But fcic.gov, you can download the report. It's also available in bookstores. Public Affairs has published it. It's being sold in bookstores. You can order it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble. But if people go to the web at fcic.gov, you know, my real hope is people read this book because I will tell you, I had spent a lot of my life in the private sector in finance, and I was stunned by what I learned this year. I was shocked. The extent to which our financial system went from being a system to support the real economy, companies, job creation, wealth creation in this country, to a system that was about money making money, financial engineering alone, I think, to the great detriment of the country. So it's I believe it's all laid out there. It's a history that I think will stand the test of time.
Alice in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Alice.
Hi. I was just wanting to comment on the mention of J.P. Morgan as being part of the shadow banking system and not heavily regulated. I work in the legal department there, and we spend an enormous amount of time making sure that all our transactions comply with the banking regulations at J.P. Morgan, the bank, as well as its securities firm, are subject to. And so we're not like a Bear Stearns or even like a Goldman Sachs. We were a bank.
Did I mention it? I think Brian may have mentioned JP.
I asked you. This includes the big investment firms like Goldman and Chase, I asked, yes.
Well, right. But
can I say something on that score? Here's one thing that did happen. I mean, obviously the five big investment banks were Goldman, Bear, Lehman, Merrill, and Morgan Stanley. But one thing that did happen is that institutions like J.P. Morgan and Citigroup were allowed to move into areas in securities and in beyond their former roles as pure bankers as a result of a lot of the changes in law. And so the fact is, I agree on the phone with our, I guess, Alice, that J.P. Morgan had a higher level of regulation. And by the way, their leverage ratio was more like 16 to 20 to 1 versus Morgan Stanley at 40 to 1. They were more tightly regulated, but still, a lot of the banks were able to engage in less regulated functions as a result of that competition I talked about earlier.
Could I just add, though, that
sure.
J.P. Morgan, I thought it was your report, or maybe it was the media, did note that J.P. Morgan was the only large bank that wasn't in danger during the credit crunch. And, in fact, we took over Ailing Bear Stearns
yes.
and a lot of their employees, and we also took over WaMu after the FDIC put them in receivership.
Now, and by the way, in our report, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said that 12 of the 13 biggest financial institutions were on the verge of collapse. He wouldn't name the 13th. Many have speculated that that is J.P. Morgan, but I should just note that he didn't note that, but he did say that it was his belief that 12 of the 13 major financial institutions would have collapsed very quickly but for government assistance.
So, Alice, do we conclude from this that it was the fact that J.P. Morgan Chase was subject to more government regulations than some of the others?
Absolutely.
That is the reason that this was the one that was not on the brink of collapse?
Well, no, because Citibank was, like J.P. Morgan, part of a bank holding company and a member of the Federal Reserve, unlike Goldman and Morgan Stanley at the time. Those two institutions have now chosen to become bank holding companies and therefore are can borrow from the Federal Reserve. But, yes, we've always been subject to more regulation.
Right, but you don't see a relationship there, cause and effect, the regulation having protected, Alice, in your opinion.
Well, can I jump in here? And then you'll go, Phil.
But Alice, in your opinion,
that is the following. First of all, Citi took enormous risks that appears J.P. Morgan did not in those securities areas. The second thing, and I think there's a hand in hand, there was a absence of regulation, but also, look, there are big breakdowns in corporate governance, and I will say Jamie Dimon himself said he places a lot of the responsibility on the management team. So even though there might have been light regulation, that does not excuse a lot of these companies for having taken enormous risk with in the marketplace that, of course, we all paid for.
So, Alice, we thank you for your call. And Phil Angelides, we thank you very much. And we'll pick it up next week.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Phil Angelides, chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. He's going to come on with us every Thursday all this month. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we will spend the last few minutes of our program today just taking your calls on whether or not you like this bill passed by the city council. And the mayor's probably going to sign it to ban smoking in all city parks, beaches, and pedestrian malls like Times Square in New York City. Pro or con? So far, it's running about 3-2 in favor on our It's a Free Country poll. How about you? 212-433-WNYC. And if you're a smoker, what are you going to do? 212-433-9692. Are you going to avoid the parks? Are you going to stand outside the park? Is this what we're going to see now? People standing just outside the park smoking on the street like they stand just outside their office buildings? 212-433-WNYC. Should the mayor sign the bill? 212-433-9692.